My name is Paul Weber, and the co-founder of Teleclass Education is Dr. Syed Sattar. On behalf of us both, I'd like to welcome you to the Teleclass today. And I got to tell you, I am really excited about this Teleclass. Today we bring you Zoonosis from Pets. And this is an exciting Teleclass for several reasons. We're hearing more and more all the time about diseases of an animal origin wreaking havoc on human health. So it's exciting to talk about that, but more importantly, it's an exciting Teleclass because of the very exciting and very energetic faculty member who is giving it. Dr. Corey Brown comes to us from the University of Georgia, although she is in Long Island, New York today. Dr. Brown has a DVM from the University of Guelph in Canada, a PhD from the University of California. For several years, she was the head of pathology at the Plum Island Foreign Animal Diseases Laboratory. She is internationally renowned in emerging infectious diseases, particularly those that can be used as an agroterror or bioterror agent. She's currently in the Department of Pathology at the University of Georgia College of Veterinary Medicine, where her students voted her best professor. So from the University of Georgia to give the Teleclass Zoonosis from Pets, it is my honor once again to introduce Dr. Corey Brown. Corey.
Oh, Paul, thank you so much. What a lovely introduction. I'm very happy to be speaking to so many of my colleagues today and about a subject that is really, as you mentioned, very timely, zoonosis. I imagine many of you have had occasion to have to define this term to your friends and colleagues who may not be as scientifically based as we are. Zoonosis, it's really a surprise that this term is not more firmly entrenched in the mindset of the general public, given that we have seen so many emerging zoonotic diseases over the past couple of decades. Of course, zoonosis is a term that was coined by Rudolf Virchow half a century ago, and he named this word on the basis of the work that he was doing on Trichinella. Of course, now we know that many diseases of humans are zoonotic. Of the 1,400 known pathogens that will infect humans, about 60% come from animals. That's a huge amount. And then of the emerging diseases that we've seen, fully three-quarters have an animal origin. Zoonoses. We see more and more about this. I was just looking on the internet this morning, and there was a story about PetSmart, which is a very large retail outfit for selling people pets and pet supplies. And just yesterday they sold someone a kitten, or they discovered that a kitten that had been sold was infected with rabies, certainly the most feared zoonosis from pets. They had taken the whole litter of kittens in, sold them, and one of the cats was reported to be ataxic and lurching. Turned out it had rabies. I can just imagine the number of post-exposure prophylaxis that will have to be carried out as a result of that kitten. Well, we're going to talk about zoonoses from pets in three different categories today. There are many, I like to refer to as the old faithfuls. These are diseases that people have gotten from their pets for decades, if not centuries. We'll cover those. Then we'll do some of the newer ones, some of which are really quite frightening, and I call these pretty scary. And then last but not least, we will visit some that are really kind of a little bit wild and on the increase, and avian flu will be one of these. So if we go to the next slide, there is a picture there, a painting there, by an artist, Georgia O'Keeffe. Of course, she's better known for her flowers. This particular painting is called Black Canyon, and I put it on there because it reminds me so much of what a histologic picture of stratified squamous epithelium looks like. Many of our old faithful zoonotic diseases do affect the skin of humans. In fact, it has been shown that 10% of all cases presented at a human dermatology clinic, many areas are due to diseases acquired from pets. Down in the lower left is a really up close and personal. That's a mole that I had removed from my chin. little bit more epithelium. As you can see in the middle, there's a big old hair follicle. I had this mole that started sprouting a big hair, and I said, you know, that's got to go. So there we have it. The next slide describes the three big types of mange, all zoonotic, that we see in humans. Sarcoptes, although many species have their own sarcoptes, and there is a sarcoptes that infects humans specifically. Most of the time when we see mange in humans, it's from dogs, and it's Sarcoptes scabii var canis. Of course, all of these Sarcoptes scabii mites, when they infect species, can be referred to as scabies. So you may hear of scabies more in a human context than an animal context. Usually when it's in animals, we're more likely to refer to it as mange rather than scabies. All of these sarcoptic mites are species-specific. They get onto a new host. They have a limited ability to cause disease. They usually can't complete their life cycle, but they're tremendously itchy while they're doing that. So Sarcoptes is far and away the most common type of zoonotic mange. And then we have two other kind of also-rans, Chylotiella and Notoedres. On the next slide, which is titled Sarcoptic Mange, you see some pictures of what a dog would look like with sarcoptic mange. Pigs have their own variety of Sarcoptes scabii, and humans will get Sarcoptes from the pig mite also. This is referred to as pig handler's itch. Most of the cases of mange, zoonotic mange in humans, are due to Sarcoptes that we get from dogs. And it has been shown that almost, well, as many as half the cases that we see in dogs eventually will go to humans. There on the bottom left is a picture of the robust sarcoptic mite, which is fairly easy to find when it's on a dog. You do a skin scraping, use a scalpel blade just to make sure that you can get enough, that you just get a little blood on the surface that ensures that you have a thickness that's intense enough to allow you to see the mite. But usually by the time when the mites are on humans, we're much less likely to find the mite. So diagnosing the cases in humans usually requires that we diagnose the case in the dog that gave it to the human. So the next slide with the four visuals shows what this mange can look like in humans. It often happens on areas of exposure to the animal. Now, that last slide on the bottom right, this is a real case of sarcoptic mange in a human that was exposed to a dog with sarcoptes. This mite can travel through clothing and bedding. So if you have an area where a dog is sleeping and then a human being sits there afterwards, you do actually get lesions in these kinds of locations. The following slide shows some of the preferred sites where we might see sarcoptic mange in humans. And the upper right shows the mechanism whereby the mite causes disease. These mites like to burrow down into past the stratum corneum, and then during the period of reproduction when they're actually mating and doing the oviposition, they are very, very itchy. So it's an intense pruritus, and anybody who's ever had mange can probably attest to the intensity of the itching. As I mentioned, it is self-limiting, so after about 6 weeks it will go away, but 6 weeks is a long time to be very itchy. So then we have two also-rans in terms of mange-causing mites. Notoedres cati is found, as the name suggests, in cats. It's especially found around the head area. We don't see much of this in the U.S. This is a kind of mange that's far more common in Japan and Europe. It looks exactly like sarcoptic mange when it gets into humans, and even the mite has some similarities. This robust kind of mite is seen in skin scrapings from the cats. Then the third kind of mange, Chylotiella, used to be a kind of mange that we would see in humans that were around animal facilities. It tended to be fairly common in laboratory rabbits, and this is Kylotiella yasguri, and it goes from species to species. So there is not the species specificity in this mite that we see in the others. Very pruritic. As you can see from the picture on the lower right, the mite itself looks a little bit different. And this, we're seeing the backside of a cat in this picture, and you can see just a few white specks. In the next slide, we see some lesions on a human, and we see the very characteristic feature of Kylotiella mange, which is walking dandruff. These mites don't burrow quite as far down into the epithelium. They stay out on the superficial part of the stratum corneum. What happens is they're so superficial that a whole raft of epithelial cells will become displaced and adherent to the top of the mite. So then when they walk around, they're carrying these little covers of epithelium, and it does look, it is dandruff, but it's moving around. So walking dandruff. And all three of those types are really very pruritic. It's not uncommon. I know lots of veterinarians, vet students who've had sarcoptic mange. Members of my family have had sarcoptic mange as a result of being exposed to dogs with mange. Where we usually see mange in dogs tends to be in animals that are perhaps not kept under the very best of circumstances. It may be substandard husbandry, poor nutrition, cold, crowded, humid conditions. Probably the next most common disease that's transmitted from animals to humans in terms of skin diseases and pets would be ringworm. Ringworm is, of course, a fungus, and we know that probably up to 30% of the cases that are seen in animals lead to human involvement as well. It's very common. I don't think I know any veterinarians who haven't had ringworm at least once. It is pretty contagious. Now, ringworm, the organism, is Microsporum canis. It's really quite unusual because Microsporum canis is found in almost all cats. It's estimated that 90% of cats carry Microsporum canis, but they often don't become ill from it. When it gets into dogs, and if the husbandry situation is not adequate, it causes this alopecia, you get the ring of hyperemia, and the animals really look kind of pathetic, as you can see in those dachshunds there. The next slide shows what the lesion looks like, a closer picture of a ringworm lesion on a human. As is typical of many fungi, there is a red ring around the edge. The fungus likes to be well oxygenated. So as it grows, it opens up the blood vessels. We see hyperemia, and the area in the middle dies. It continues moving to the outside, so you get an expanding red ring. Confirmation of the organism requires culturing, which you can see with the fungal auger that has a growth on it down on the bottom left. And this is an organism that gets into the hair follicles, as you can see on the right. All those little black dots, the spores, are growing within the hair shaft in the hair follicle. And that's why we get the alopecia, because it's growing within the hairs. The hairs become all degenerated, and the animal loses its hair. Then on the next slide, I think Gary Larson, he has a degree in entomology, and I think he really understands a lot about disease transmission. And in this particular cartoon, the dogs are saying, check their papers, they're probably forged, they'll scratch the furniture, and they'll transmit ringworm, referring to the cats that are trying to get into the ark. You know, it's probably true, the cats do carry ringworm. So those are some of the skin diseases that we worry about for our old faithful zoonotic diseases. Then if we look at some diseases that are, this disease is a little bit more serious. Cutaneous larva migrans is caused by having human skin contact areas where there are hookworm larvae. These are especially hookworms from dogs and cats, and because the hookworm larvae require a certain kind of ambient conditions. It should be warm. It should be moist. We primarily see it in the southeastern United States. So it's not such a problem in northern parts of North America. However, it's seen a great deal in the Caribbean. So I would imagine that there would be an awful lot of cases in Canada of people who come back from the Caribbean. They've been walking on the beach, and of course before they were walking on the beach, there were dogs and cats walking on the beach, and these larvae get into the skin and they tunnel through and they cause tremendous pruritus. It's very itchy, and we get these characteristic serpiginous tracts. As you can see on the next slide, which demonstrates the life cycle, and over on the left, there's a serpiginous tract moving through someone's arm, and on the right, and on the lower right, you can see the really destructive nature of these tracts as the larvae make an abortive attempt to move through the tissue. Huge eosinophil reaction, and they're very, very itchy. Now, it's been shown that what some people do, they're so itchy, and people know that there's a migrating larva in there. There have been many cases where people try and go in and they dig out the larva. But in fact, the reaction forms after the larva's already been through there. So if you're going to dig out the larva, you have to actually project beyond where the red line is in order to get rid of it. And this next slide of a hand showing nice little, these snake-like tracks, this is a veterinary student that we had at the University of Georgia. She went camping on the Appalachian Trail. She stopped in my office and she said, "What do you think I have?" I got very excited. I got my camera out and I said, "I'm sure you have cutaneous larva migrans." In fact, then she went to the dermatologist and had it confirmed. So those are some of the old faithfuls that we worry about, zoonotic diseases from pets. Then we'll go to the next category, and I'm going to call these the pretty scary. These are the ones that will do more than make you itchy or cause your hair to fall out. These are much more severe, probably the most common zoonotic infection in North America would be this one, visceral larva migrans. Virtually all dogs and cats have intestinal worms when they're young. The hookworm larvae, of course, those are the ones that can make the animals really sick, and they can also cause the cutaneous larva migrans. The roundworms, though, cause a different kind of disease when they get into humans. And the roundworms, these are the Toxocara species. Larvae from these worms, so when the animals defecate out the eggs and they larvate, and human beings, usually children, pick up the larvae and they're ingested, they undergo an aberrant migration in the human body. They often go to the eye, sometimes to the brain, lung, or liver, and when they're in the eye, they form a granuloma, and the CDC records 750 cases per year of unilateral blindness due to visceral larva migrans. And when it's in the eye, they call it ocular larva migrans. So this is very common, and if it goes to a bad spot such as the retina, it's quite unfortunate. And what is even more unfortunate is that this disease is completely preventable. If people are advised properly and take the advice about how to keep their puppies and kitties properly wormed, then there should be no danger for the humans who are associated with the animals. Another zoonotic agent, we're on the next slide now, which is labeled toxoplasma. Another zoonotic agent that can cause great problems with inflammation in the brain and sometimes the eye is an organism that I think is really pretty misunderstood. This is toxoplasma. There's a great concern about pregnant women getting exposed to toxoplasma during the first trimester of pregnancy, because there's concern, a well-founded concern, that at this point the toxoplasma can cross the placental barrier and cause problems in the developing fetus. And so there are an awful lot of cases recorded every year where a child is born with some sort of congenital deformity or neurologic impairment because of in utero infection with toxoplasma. Now, when I say that this disease is misunderstood, I think that most people believe that we get this disease from cats. Well, that's only partially true. If you look at this diagram on the following slide where the cat is king up at the top, and I must say that's a pretty scary-looking cat, the cat is the definitive host. So the cat is the only species in which this organism replicates in the intestine and is expelled in the feces. So without cats, we wouldn't have any toxoplasma. But then what happens to these cat feces with the oocysts in it can get into other animals. And in other animals, it does what it does in us, and that is it forms cysts in different tissues, usually without any clinical signs. So if those cysts form in muscle, and then that muscle is turned into meat and it's insufficiently cooked, the pregnant woman can get the toxoplasma that way. And it's probable that most cases of toxoplasma acquired are due to undercooked meat rather than due to exposure to cat feces. Now, about half of us have antibodies to toxoplasma. So that means one out of every two North Americans has these quiescent cysts somewhere in their body. That's a very high prevalence rate. Now, if you look at the next slides, there are, I would say probably half of us have a cyst somewhere in our brain. Up at the top left, you see a quiescent cyst, and then that larger histologic picture shows what happens when the immune system breaks down and the cyst is allowed to rupture. What we end up with is an encephalitis. And of course, this is what's seen in many AIDS patients. What I find really scary is that there's recent evidence to show that even if the cysts don't rupture, even if we don't have inflammation, there is a positive correlation between being infected with toxoplasma and schizophrenia. That most, if not all, patients with schizophrenia are also serologically positive to toxoplasma. So it may be that toxoplasma might be a trigger for a more chronic disease, a chronic neurologic disorder that has been unrecognized, which would make toxoplasma even more scary. And the picture on the lower right is painted by Vincent van Gogh, who, as we all know, did suffer from schizophrenia. So that's toxoplasma can be a scary disease. Another scary disease that's associated with, not with pet mammals, but rather with pet birds, psittacosis. Can be a very debilitating disease. Flu-like illness can cause pneumonia, hepatitis, severe headache, and this is a disease you can get again and again and again. You don't seem to develop any immunity or protection to it. It's primarily the cytisine birds, the parrots, the macaws, the parakeets that transmit this disease. We see in our diagnostic laboratory at the University of Georgia, we diagnose psittacosis on a regular basis in pet birds. They'll be sick, they'll have large spleens, large livers, and those are the days when you're really glad you've worn your surgical mask while you were doing the postmortem, because this organism will aerosolize and it can be inhaled and cause disease. And if you look at the picture on the lower right with all the bird feces on the floor, this is where all the Chlamydophila psittaci are. They're excreted out in the feces, and then those feces can aerosolize. I know that's really not a very pleasant thing to imagine, but that is what happens. The birds don't have to be clinically ill to be spreading the disease either. It can move from healthy-looking animals into humans. Next slide, Campylobacter. I suppose we're all probably well aware that Campylobacter is the most common cause of so-called, you know, stomach flu that we see. It's responsible for so many days of work missed, probably the most common cause of non-hospitalized gastroenteritis that we see in North America. we tend to incriminate a lot of food products for Campylobacter, and rightfully so, poultry meat in particular. There's a very high prevalence rate of Campylobacter infecting poultry meat in the supermarkets. Of course, effective cooking will kill it, and we remember, you know, the big problem with Campylobacter is after you cut up the chicken on the chicken board, after you cut up the chicken on the cutting board, then you really need to wash the cutting board before you make the salad, because lots of times that's how the disease is transferred. We also see it in contamination of water and sometimes wild birds. But I think what many people don't recognize is that a certain percentage of the cases that happen in humans actually come from pets, especially pets that are kept in a shelter kind of environment. And hold that thought, because we're going to come back to that shelter environment. Oh, and incidentally, the rabies kitten that we talked about at the very beginning, that kitten came from a shelter also. We probably need to be paying a lot more attention to the health of animals in a population sense in many of these rescue kinds of environments. So a high percentage of dogs that are kept in group conditions will be positive. They're shedding Campylobacter in their feces, and we know about dog hygiene. We know what they do. You know, they lick their anus, and then they try to lick us. And this is how disease could be transferred. And by the way, that's my son from about 10 years ago. And you can see how there's good possibility for transfer of one mucous membrane to another. The next slide is Salmonella. Do we get Salmonella from pets? I'm about to make the case that we do. Salmonella, we tend to think about Salmonella as coming from food-producing animals. Well, it actually requires a pretty hefty dose to inoculate. Unlike some of the other pathogens, you have to get a million organisms ingested before you're going to see disease. But when you do see the disease, it can be pretty serious. 500 people per year die in the U.S. as a result of Salmonella in the intestine. On the lower left, you can see a picture of a calf intestine. This calf was infected with Salmonella, and there's just this nasty, ulcerating, fibrinonecrotic enterocolitis. Humans get the same thing. And so as it gets more severe, it's just not compatible with life. Well, Salmonella was named after Daniel Salmon, whose picture is in the upper right. He was the first veterinarian to qualify for licensure in the United States. And he spent all of his time working on hog cholera and contagious bovine pleuropneumonia. So it's always been a mystery to me as to why they named Salmonella after him. Then on the lower right, there are many ways to get Salmonella. Here I am in St. Mark's Square in Venice. And I was working there with the veterinary school close by, and the microbiologists were doing a study and had found that 30% of all the pigeons in St. Mark's Square are positive for Salmonella. So this is an area where you feed the birds and then you go have some popcorn. Tremendous opportunities for transfer of infection. But let's get back to how you might get this disease from pets. Well, I can think of a few ways. This article, reptile owner donates blood, passes on Salmonella. This happened a couple of years ago. This was a young man, apparently healthy. He owned a boa constrictor, and he was healthy enough to donate his platelets. Several people got his donated platelets. All the people who got the platelets became ill, and one of the people died. They isolated Salmonella from the recipients. They went back and looked at the donor. Then they looked at the donor's environment. The donor had a boa constrictor that was loaded with Salmonella. Many, many reptiles have Salmonella. 97% of all pet iguanas have Salmonella. 100% of red-eared slider turtles less than 4 inches in length have Salmonella. So anytime you're dealing with people who have reptiles for pets, it's important to emphasize, wash your hands. Then on the lower right, that's the south end of a cat walking north. It has been shown that cats grouped in shelters, once again, we have this group kind of situation that can foster much more disease. We're seeing multi-drug resistant Salmonella in group housed cats. Well, multi-drug resistant Salmonella is probably not something that we want getting spread into the human population if we can avoid it at all. But that did happen. If we look at the next slide, there were so many cases associated with multi-drug-resistant salmonella as a result of pet rodents. I mean, look at that cute little hamster there on the lower right. Well, there were 15 cases, 10 different states. These are 15 cases that were actually reported to the hospital. Patients were hospitalized, and salmonella was isolated. Undoubtedly, there were more cases than this. But of those 15 hospitalized cases, 8 of them were under 7 years of age. An individual of that age can dehydrate so quickly, it's really of great concern. The diagram for Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Review shows the tremendous interconnection. I mean, I work in animal health all the time, and I had no idea that these pet distributors were so intertwined. I mean, this isn't an organizational or distributive chart. It looks more like a Jackson Pollock drawing where everything is interconnected. How can you do tracebacks and monitoring when there's so much cross-trafficking of animals? Another disease that I think is pretty scary, Clostridium difficile. CDAD, Clostridium difficile-associated disease. This is increasing in humans, and it happens in humans that are given antibiotics, so it's primarily seen in hospital settings and long-term care facilities. There was a very interesting study done at the Ontario Veterinary College, my alma mater, that was published just very recently, where they were looking at some of the dogs that were being taken in for this pet-assisted therapy. You may be familiar with this therapy where people take companion animals into long-term care facilities, old age homes, in to visit children who are undergoing cancer therapy and so on, because it's been found to have a very positive association with the outlook of the patients, decreases blood pressure, increases hope, and so on. There are so many mental benefits of association with pets and animals. And in this one study done at the Ontario Veterinary College, they looked at a group of dogs that was being taken into these facilities on a regular basis, and there was a very adorable 4-year-old toy poodle that had the horrible strain of Clostridium difficile, the ribotype 027, toxinotype 3, which is the one that is responsible for what we're seeing in humans now. Was not causing any problem in the dog, and it has not been recorded in dogs. It's quite probable that this dog picked it up from one of these long-term care facilities. So, wait a minute, does that make it a zoonosis or an anthraponosis? Yeah, everything is interconnected, but there's the probability that this dog would then take it on to the next facility. Yes, like the lines in an Escher drawing, we're all interconnected. So then we'll go on to the last category, and these are the zoonoses from pets that are either increasing or just really kind of bizarre, and I wanted to share them with you. Sporothrix schenkii is a dimorphic fungus. It lives in the environment, and when it gets into people, which it usually does in especially rose gardeners. So as you cut yourself with the thorns and are exposed to the soil, you may get these granulomatous, kind of pustular, ulcerating lesions that might track partway up your arm. And usually MDs are clued in to the fact that you can get this from the environment. So it's one of these situations where it's occupationally related. We see it in cats also. Now, what we thought was that you had to pick it up from the environment. So you see it in the cat or you see it in the human, but you don't usually see it in both. This is changing now. We're finding that, in fact, people can get it from cats. So the cats are contagious. Now, if we look at the next slide, which has a nice cytology smear of the exudate from the lesion in a cat, you see these macrophages and neutrophils that are loaded with these organisms, each one surrounded by a halo. That is the fungal organism. That's in a cat. Then you see the lesion in a human finger. If you did a smear on that, you wouldn't see these organisms, because we only see them in cats. So if you have a human who gets the disease from a cat, no history of working with the roses or being a gardener or any kind of occupational exposure, we need to know that it is contagious from cats to humans. Otherwise, we would never be able to diagnose it in the human. Okay, the next one with a picture of the raccoon on the top. We talked before about Toxocara species, the roundworms that are found in dogs and cats where the eggs are defecated out from the intestine. The adults live in the intestine of the animal. The eggs are defecated out. Humans ingest the eggs, and we get these granulomas that form in various parts of the body. The story is the same with the raccoon roundworm, with an exception. With that visceral larva migrans, where we get granulomas forming in the body, usually little granulomas form, and they stop there. The larva stops migrating. That doesn't happen with the raccoon ascarid. With the raccoon ascarid, these larvae, when they get into humans, continue migrating throughout the body. They especially like the tissue of the brain. Now, most raccoons carry these ascarids, and it's been estimated, if we go to the next slide, that millions of these ascarid eggs can be laid every day. They're extremely hardy, quite sticky, so they like to stick to things like plastic toys, children's fingers, and so on. And then when they get into the body, they migrate through the brain. That upper left histo picture, the two pictures on the right, the one on the upper left, are the larvae within the brain of a child who has died from migrating raccoon ascarid larvae. And, of course, on the right, that's Gustav Klimt, the KISS, and I thought there was enough similarity to put those two together. These eggs survive for a long time. If you want to decontaminate a raccoon cage, it's recommended that you use a blowtorch. This disease is increasing largely because of our suburban nature, and the raccoons have really prospered as a result of the way that we have moved out from the cities into the countryside. Lots more room for them to prowl among the garbage cans. Another parasitic disease, zoonotic disease we can get from pets that's on the increase is on the next page, alveolar hydatid disease. Echinococcus. So this is a cestode. It's a tapeworm with a complex life cycle. It lives in the intestine of the Arctic carnivores. So we're talking about fox, coyotes, wolves. They have the tapeworm in their intestines. Dogs can pick it up too. Dogs are close enough to these animals that they will support the infection as well. They'll have it in their intestine. So then the eggs are defecated out, and in the natural system, a rodent will pick up the eggs, and a rodent will form these cysts in visceral organs. The carnivore comes along, eats the rodent, and the cycle is completed. Well, humans can function just like the rodent. So humans can pick up the disease. We'll go to the next page. And there we have hydatid cysts forming in the liver of a rabbit. The same thing will happen in the liver of a human. So we'll go to the next page, and you can see in that top left picture, this is a surgeon removing multiple hydatid cysts from the liver of a patient who has ingested those eggs from the Arctic tapeworm. Now, he could have gotten those eggs from a dog, could have gotten it from a fox defecating in a lettuce bed, many ways. Usually the disease is not diagnosed until about half of the liver is gone. Very difficult. Really the only treatment is surgical. Mortality rate associated with this particular parasite is very high. Quite worrisome. Another worrisome disease, the next slide, and of course this is the plague. We're seeing an increase in the plague in the U.S. The southwestern U.S. has plenty of plague, and it circulates in the groups of prairie dogs that you can see on the bottom right. Prairie dogs, oh, they're so cute. Oh, not. prairie dogs have caused lots of problems over the last few years, not the least of which was monkeypox. But cats are picking up the infected rodents, and then they bring either the infected rodents or the disease or the fleas back to where humans are living and spread the disease that way. If we look at the next slide that's labeled plague in cats looks just like plague in humans. Most cases are characterized by the big buboes, the big abscesses forming in the lymph nodes, which in cats are usually around the head because that's where they get exposed as they stick their head into the rodent burrow. About 15% of the cases in cats are pneumonic. Of course, the pneumonic form of plague can spread via aerosol, and this is of great concern when it enters a veterinary clinic. Usually barrier nursing is extremely important to protect the people who are exposed to the cat that has the respiratory form. The next slide is just a picture of what happens in humans when they're infected. We see inguinal and axillary buboes, these big expanding lymph nodes filled with necrosis and pus. There can be gangrene associated with the disease because of all these toxins that are contained in the so-called Yap virulon, which is part of the organism. So that poor individual in the lower right is probably going to lose his nose and his toes due to this disease. So that's plague. Let's move on to some on the increase and really pretty wild diseases from bite wounds. Well, I find it amazing that 1% of all emergency room visits are due to one organism biting another. Of course, quite a few of these are due to humans biting another human, but probably number one on the list are dog bites. Now, if you get bitten by a cat, chances are you will get a local infection there. It'll be polymicrobial, but you won't become ill and you will certainly survive. If you're bitten by a dog, often we don't get that local infection, but if you happen to have a characteristic that would make you susceptible to a new organism that has been found from dogs, it could be the end for you. We'll look at the next slide. This organism, Capnocytophaga canamorsis, which is really a mouthful, 17% of all dogs carry this organism, and if it gets into someone who has a higher than normal level of iron in their blood, it can cause peripheral symmetrical gangrene, encephalitis, and most definitely death. And what will cause you to have elevated iron? Well, alcoholism will, because that changes things in the liver, making for high iron levels in the blood. Having your spleen removed will also do it. Capnocytophaga canamorsis, difficult to diagnose, difficult to grow, and difficult to survive. Another disease that you can get from being scratched by a cat, and this is a disease that is most definitely on the increase, this is Bartonella. Cats will be bacteremic for as long as 18 months, and it's thought that fleas take the bacteria from one cat to another. If you happen to be scratched during that period of bacteremia, also maybe the flea dirt may also get in at the time of that scratch, you'll have cat scratch disease. We see up on the upper right, that's Ted Nugent, better known for cat scratch fever. So the cute little kitten on the lower left brings a terrible disease with cervical lymphadenopathy, malaise, it's refractory to antibiotics, and about 7% of all veterinarians are positive for cat scratch fever disease. Okay, our last category, those that are on the increase, the disease du jour. We'll look at this field of turkeys where one is saying, achoo, and the other one says, very funny, Dave. Yes, what are we going to do about avian influenza? Are pets involved in avian influenza? The next slide shows the number of countries that have reported avian influenza in people. Well, this is from the 12th of May. I looked up the statistics today. As of today, there are 227 cases of laboratory-confirmed H5N1 and 154 deaths. It has been reported, the human disease has been reported in 10 countries, and the avian disease, the presence of the virus, has been reported in 48 countries. The next slide was from an ABC made-for-TV movie, Fatal Contact, Bird Flu in America. And I especially liked the one review I read of it that said, ABC unleashes a plague of bad acting. Yeah, this movie certainly served to heighten the general public interest in and perhaps panic about bird flu. Well, do we need to be worried about bird flu? Is it a human disease? No, not yet. We look at this next slide, however, it is most definitely, it can infect cats. We saw many cats, large cats in the zoos in Southeast Asia succumbing to avian influenza. Some experiments were done to infect cats. In fact, cats are very susceptible to the virus and they will spread it from cat to cat. The next slide, we've seen a few cases in dogs. We've seen a case in a stone marten. But so far, there does not seem to be sustained spread within species other than birds. We know that human beings have the receptor for the avian influenza, but the receptors are deep within the alveoli, so it really requires a kind of massive inspiration in order to get the virus down to the area that it needs to take hold in the human body. So it has not yet mutated to the point where it may spread human to human, and most of the virology experts say probably won't. Look at the next slide, which is once again that Escher drawing. We are all interconnected. The next slide shows quite a few of the hind ends of animals to remind me that we're near the end. I would just like to tell you about one new zoonotic disease that really has some local flavor because it is a disease from Canada, and it's a disease that comes from plants, Cryptococcus gattii. There was a cluster of cases, about 100 cases in humans on Vancouver Island. Cryptococcus gattii had formerly been recorded from koala in Australia, but this was unusual in that Cryptococcus gattii was infecting so many people who were not immunocompromised. They looked at the environment. We'll go to the next slide, and it was evident that this cryptococcus comes from the eucalyptus trees. Oh, maybe that's where the koalas got it. We saw lesions in multiple body systems in humans, in dogs, cats, horses, a llama, and dolphins. So many species were infected, and it appears they all got it from plants, from the red gum eucalyptus. So if zoonosis is a disease that affects animals, humans that comes from animals, and anthraponosis is a disease that affects animals that comes from humans, I think we can call a plant disease a botanosis. What are we likely to see in the future? Well, as this picture depicts, what will we see when we pick up the coffee cup and look at the coffee grounds underneath? I believe there is no predicting. I do think it's important to look at microbiology from an evolutionary perspective, look at it from an evolutionary biology point of view. The microbes are trying to survive. They get into a new environment. They're going to try to thrive. We need to think about how the agents move around the world, how they move from one species to another, and be prepared to respond to whatever the next threat turns out to be. So I thank you very much.
Dr. Brown, thank you for another fascinating teleclass presentation. I'm glad that I have a mute button on my phone, or you would have heard me laughing out loud a couple of times. I'm really surprised that human infection control community doesn't really address zoonotic infections very often in our conferences and lectures. Is there any kind of an online course where this type of information can be explored?
You know, I believe that this is a big gap. Well, when you see a gap, you can say, oh, no, why don't we have that? And you can also say, oh, boy, here's an opportunity. So, yeah, the glass is half empty, but it's also half full, and I think it's a a great possibility for someone to make a terrific impact?
Well, take that as a no. There isn't presently an online course.
I was just wondering what zoonosis is implicated with goats. In petting zoos.
Goats in petting zoos. I think E. coli 0157 has been recorded from goats. Q fever, I think, is also an issue with all small ruminants. So that would only be at the time when they're kidding or lambing.
Okay.
But that's a possibility also. But I'm pretty sure there was a report recently about goats giving children E. coli 0157H7.
The whole issue of petting zoos, what do we think about that, Dr. Brown?
Oh, my God, they're such a bad idea. Yeah, I worry about them a lot. There must be a better way to teach our communities about farming and where food comes from than to have people come in and put their hands on them. And usually the people who are coming, they're bringing their children, so we're exposing youngsters.
And I noticed recently in a mall not too far away from where I live, there was a petting zoo came right into the mall with all sorts of barnyard animals, and there was you could pay some money to get some grain or things to feed these animals by hand. Nowhere to be seen was there any alcohol, sanitizer, or hand-washing facilities. The washrooms were at the other end of the building.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, no one's washing their hands afterward. So thanks to everyone for joining us today. Dr. Brown, a special thanks to you for all of your effort and preparation and energy. You can certainly expect another invitation for our 2007 teleclass series.
Thank you all.
Until we meet again, folks, goodbye.